Welcome to the XYZ Experiment Podcast. Today in the studio, I have Fiona and Luke, and we have a guest today, Dr. Akane Kanai, who is a researcher at Monash University and researches across feminism, gender, and race in media, including social media and pop culture. And we are so thankful to have you today to chat about all sorts of things, but including your podcast as well. So welcome.
Thank you so much, Dash. I'm so pleased to be here today.
We're thrilled to have you today, like yeah. Really thrilled. The first question we always ask any guest is, what generation do you belong to?
I guess I am a millennial, so that's Gen Y.
Yeah.
It's funny because I belong to a research area where there's a lot of controversy about framing things in terms of generations. You know, it's always been talked about in terms of producing more conflict than we need, or, you know. But I think it's kind of fun also. I mean, it always gets people talking to talk about generations as well. But yeah, I'm millennial.
And what's the most millennial thing about you?
The most millennial thing about me is probably the my furniture aesthetic, which is kind of like a sort of mid-century style with, like, you know, boho rugs and, yeah. Anyway, and lots of plants. I think that's, like, pretty millennial. So sorry, not sorry. That's my, interior design style.
I love that one. We haven't had that one yet. That's
no
a really good You're saying yes, Dash. You're going yes.
Well,
yes.
I'm just thinking of all of my friends' houses and how, like, similar they all look. And it's true. The millennials do have a design look.
They do. They do. Yeah.
Akane, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Wow. So I live in Melbourne, in Brunswick. My friend just sent me an Age article that said that Brunswick has the highest population of academics in Melbourne.
Oh.
So I guess I am typical of the suburb. I live with my partner, my baby, who is 16 months, and our staffy, Lena, who has her own public Instagram. She's the only one that has a public account.
And tell us a little bit about your research.
My research really looks at, I guess, how identity politics change through media culture. And I've focused a lot in my work on social media. Something I've been really interested in over time is looking at how feminism has changed ideas of identity through popular culture, also through social media culture, I guess, and understandings of what it means to be a good feminist as well. And that is part of the podcast, I guess, that I made recently, which is part of a big project that I've been doing for a number of years now.
How do you define a feminist? What's your definition?
This question's a huge question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It could be, you know, you could actually take a full episode to discuss this, but I guess what I would say is that there are different ways to define feminism, and I guess it depends on what you want to do with it. For some people, I think a definition of feminism that is just about equality between men and women, that could serve them very well in their own lives, and that could mean actual change for them, potentially in their own social context. I think for me, what I find most useful is thinking about feminism as a movement that understands gender as a structure that produces unequal experiences in society, together with other structures that, you know, overlap and intersect with gender, and tries to address it in some way. So I think the emphasis on addressing it and doing something about the inequality is really the kind of the key part about it. Because obviously some people might understand that their unequal experiences because of gender in society, but they might not necessarily want to change that.
Just as a follow-up question then, what do you think makes someone a feminist?
I think it's someone that is in some way, well, one, cognizant that there's a level of inequality or mismatch between what they see in the world and what they feel ought to be. in the world, and then tries to move closer to the ought or the ideal. And I think that can be in many ways. So I think, you know, you don't have to be someone with a placard who's out on the streets all the time to be a feminist. I think, you know, what we've seen particularly in Anglo-American societies for decades is that feminism is a really mediated and cultural phenomenon. So it's not purely just about protesting particular policies or particular high-profile things that happen. Yeah, I definitely think there's more of a space for everyday action, and that's, I guess, what my research has been really interested in.
And how do you think that's changed? I know that you mentioned before maybe framing it across generations isn't something you're super interested in doing, but across time maybe, what reflections do you have in terms of how feminism has evolved? Because you kind of touched on this before as well about how the way we talk to one another is really impactful in that, and that's changed, and our methods of communication have also changed.
That's another, really big question. So in terms of the generational framing, I think there are some useful things about it. It's just that, I guess, just to quickly say that in research, often what, like a lot of feminist scholars have pointed out, is that often we neatly divide things into waves in Western society. So we say second wave was about this, third wave was about this, fourth wave is about this. And it presumes that everything's just getting better, which is not the case. We need to think more about the context in which different feminisms arise and the issues they were seeking to address. And it can also produce a bit of a mother-daughter framing, where it's like your mother, like your mum just didn't do a good job, and now I'm just trying, you know, trying to pick up the remains. That's like some of the critique, I guess. But I do think it's interesting to think about, I mean, different generations live in different contexts, and I think that's what's really useful. So in terms of what has changed, I think there's just so much more general culture and information about feminism that is circulating. So if we think more in more recent years, particularly since, I guess, since the Hollywood embrace of the Me Too movement, there's just, it's just been really almost unavoidable to come across a form of feminism in the media in some way. There's, you know, there's news about how we need to be addressing gendered violence that's happening all the time. You know, such a crop of high-profile movies, television, branding, empowerment, courses for women's leadership, all of those things, it's sort of really all in the water. So there's, I think what's different is that we have a really intense mediated environment that young people are coming into. So it's not as though, yeah, I don't think now if you were growing up, you would have to wait till you were, say, in your 40s to come across feminism. That's something I think that's in the water when you're really young.
Can I ask a question about feminism? How is it different to sexism? Where's the difference between them? Because to me, it seems like feminism has come out through sexism, or am I wrong with that?
No, I think, I mean, it's always about addressing sexism, I think. But I think also, I guess there are different approaches to it. So it might just say it's not just about sexism, but it's about, like, it's not just reactive. I mean, different, you know, in different parts of the world, I guess there are different ideals for how gender works. And so sometimes it's about establishing a society in which, like, how do we want to live? How do we want to respectfully allocate roles to do the work of carrying society on, you know? And we think that it's traditional that women stay at home and haven't been, and for no wage, and look after children, for example. But that is, I mean, depending on where you are historically and socially, that's not always been the case. You know, how do we, it's kind of trying to think about a whole worldview about how do we want to respectfully allocate the roles to do the work of looking out for each other and, yeah, and carrying on, I guess.
Do feminists look after each other?
Not always, I would say, because I think there's a lot of conflict about what feminism can mean. I think one thing that I wanted to explore in the podcast was this idea that I think in a lot of recent representations of feminism, there's a sense that feminists are just really empowered. They're always empowered. They're invulnerable. They can do everything, you know. But feminists are often, I mean, they're often women, not always, but often women, who are just kind of struggling to get by, who recognize a lot of what has happened in my life is because of how I've been positioned through gender, as well as other elements of identity. And I'm trying to grapple with that and make a change, you know. And sometimes what we actually need is more support on the ground. Yeah.
Well, we might circle back, because the podcast you're talking about is a podcast that you launched recently, and it's 4 episodes, and it's called Feminist Not Fearless, and it's based on a big research project that you'd been talking about that you did. I'm very curious now, listening to the response that you have just given, why that name? How did you come up with that name?
Yeah, I think it was basically because I was seeing this kind of implicit idea in the way that lots of people were framing what feminism was. So on the one hand, you have more commercial culture where it's, yeah, these kind of sassy messages that, like, you know, you don't give a fuck, or you're, you know, you have a really strong attitude, don't let anything get you down, you know, all those things. Then I guess in terms of research, there was a lot of work on what counted as activism. So actively speaking out, you know, particularly in terms of social media research, it was all about hashtag feminism. So things like Me Too, or hashtags like Been Raped, Never Reported. So really coordinated things that were about raising your voice. But I was interested in kind of the in-between. So how do people actually manage that in their everyday lives? And actually, it is still scary in lots of ways to be a woman or someone who is minoritized through their gender. And it's mainly those people who are trying to adopt a feminist ethos to change the world. So yeah. I really wanted to emphasize that people are doing this not because they don't have fear, but because they're trying to work through it and still be feminist.
Is it easier to be a feminist if you come from a place of privilege, do you think?
I think, I mean, everything's a little bit easier when you come from a place of privilege, for sure.
Yeah.
And it depends on the context in what you're talking about, because, you know, like I said, so some workplaces, there's already established very HR-friendly discourse of feminism or women, you know, women leaders, or, you know, so that can make it easier, because you can then speak to the existing ways in which feminism has been kind of adopted in that particular way. But in other places, it still might actually be quite difficult. And we've seen, you know, there is an increasing polarization online. There is also an increasing growth of very easily accessible misogyny online. Mm-hmm. So even if you are really privileged, per se, in terms of money, in terms of your networks, you know, that doesn't stop you being harassed or abused, actually. So
yeah.
So I think, for sure,
maybe even more visibly so.
Yeah. And I think that's some of the, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more as well, when we talk about celebrities as well.
Well, we can go there, actually, because I guess, you know, thinking about how social media has impacted the expression of feminism, and listening to what you were saying, you know, I know my social media feed is full of, at the moment, young women, beautiful, with their Get Ready With Me videos, which basically are like, this is what it is to be a successful woman. I'm getting up at 5 a.m. I'm going to the gym. I'm making my beautiful bed with all these pillows. I'm making my smoothie. I'm then getting ready. Great skincare routine, like tapping on all of the products, going to work, doing a full day of work, you know, then going out for drink. And I just am like, like, that's a lot to live up to. And that just seems to be like one, and there's multiple messages, but on social media, I'm like, is that what we're all meant to be doing in our life? So, sorry, back to the question in terms of how has social media played out into you know, the expressions of feminism and what might be some of the positives or negatives around that.
So that's like the 5 to 9 thing,
yeah.
Right? Where you just have to not only do your 9 to 5, but also work around the clock, basically. You don't get any break from investing in yourself.
No.
Investing, you know, in inverted commas. I think that sort of that's sort of an interesting prompt when we think about discussing what feminism means, because in sort of Western media culture, Anglo-American media culture, feminism has really been intertwined with commercial media and this idea of what can be sold to women in terms of empowering them, right? So that's a Western tradition. So it means that things like what you've described, which are actually kind of putting more and more pressure on women to do all of these things and get them done in their day, in the promise of you'll live a more serene, empowered life.
Yeah.
That can be read as feminist, even though it puts a lot more of a burden on you as an individual to do those things. So in terms of the question being about, you know, how is social media changing it? I think there's been a lot of, you know, really great research into, you know, social media identity. But one thing that comes out a lot is that it enables really easy comparison, which I think everyone can probably attest to for if you've, you know, ever used social media for more than 15 minutes. A lot of easy comparison, but yeah, increasingly a personalized address on things you can do as a person to improve your life, be a better citizen, invest more in yourself, optimize yourself, elevate your look, uplift, all of those kinds of, yeah, all those verbs, you know. So that becomes particularly intense for women, I guess, because that idea that women have to self-improve has been something that has been really ingrained in media for a long time. And it's often been couched in a feminist way as though, yeah, it's for you, but really it's so you can produce more.
Self-care.
In terms of, yeah, yeah, in terms of your work, you know, be a better capitalist worker.
That goes to an article I was reading this morning, and it was talking about women, it was talking about Katy Perry, to be honest, quite a bit, trying to put new music out. And so the way you do that is lose some weight and show more skin. And then that gets the media going, and then the real reason is to get the music out, but you need to do that first.
Yeah.
And she's giving a very empowering message, you know, I'm claiming my body back and I'm claiming my career back and blah, blah, blah. But you know, I look at that and think, oh, I just feel sad that we have to show more skin and lose weight to get the attention that we need to do our career or do what we need to do next.
Yeah.
And then I have the thought around that about, am I not being a good feminist supporting her in whatever way possible to do that, rather than looking at it going, oh, really, you have to do that? You know, does that make me not a good feminist? You know what I mean? Like it's...
No, it's a very confusing position to be in. But ultimately, I think what we have to recognize, there are so many contradictions that are out there. So it's impossible for us to fully support any one person because they themselves are subject to these contradictory demands and messages. So, and one of them is, in order to even put out your music and claim your individuality, you have to please everyone else and constantly put that individuality on hold before you can even create an album, you know. And there's the broader question of what are we asking, what are the general standards and I guess rules around who can be visible and how.
Yeah.
And I think those, taking that broader perspective is really useful because it helps contextualize why certain bodies are more visible, you know, in media to start off with, and recognize that, you know, the kind of discourse, obviously, that, or the language that Katy Perry can rely on in terms of it's my choice, it's, well, you only have a choice between the options that are available, and you can choose to present that as for yourself, which is, I'm not saying it's not, it could feel actually good for her to change her body in that way, but that doesn't change the fact that there is a society that is very punitive, one, on women's bodies and generally bodies that don't fit a particular norm, that don't look a particular way, that's incredibly ageist, mm-hmm. ableist, racist, you know.
Well, we had that with Bridgerton recently, with having the woman who's a normal body.
Yeah.
A normal body. Let's face it, she's the norm in Australia. And it was women writing the articles going, we're not ready for a bigger woman and a smaller man together. It was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, that made me depressed.
But in media, there's always been bigger men with smaller women.
Always.
Always. And we've never questioned it.
Simpsons, the Flintstones, you know, like, I mean, they're ridiculous ones to say, but that's norm. Like, it's just. But it was women. I've got this whole thing at the moment that women are cruel to each other, you know. Like, the person writing the article probably sees himself as a feminist and then dragging the other feminist down. Mm-hmm. It's like, why? Why do we have to do that to each other? I don't understand. Haven't we got enough with the men doing that, let alone us doing it to each other? Is that a fair thing to say? Or
I think, I think it's really important to have a general ethic of care, you know, and really think about that as like a general philosophy when you are trying to do feminist work. And I think it is important to have a sense of the broader context in which you think, who is benefiting from this, you know, structurally, not necessarily like, you know, individual men, but, you know, who is benefiting from certain proportions of the population being so focused on how they appear and considering that they won't be acceptable for others unless they change their body, which is who they are. Our bodies are who we are, you know. I think it's important to have space to be able to criticize, because women are often also told that you have to be so soft and nice and gentle. And I think actually a lot of women are that anyway, you know, but I think it's important to have the space for critique, but not on the basis of this individual person is the solely responsible and doing it wrong, but trying to take that individual expression and think, oh, what does that express about us collectively?
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people, like, no one is, you know, perfect in inverted commas. Like, sometimes you realize, oh, I had those presumptions too. You know, I've had discussions with friends who've said, I don't want to be with a man, this is women, who say they don't want to be with a man that is thinner than them or that or has these. And it's not saying that they think that ought to be the case. They're not saying, I think my value should be placed on a billboard, but they have grown up in a society where that's the norm. So I think it's important to kind of see those expressions also as, it's not just you know, and it's not saying that you think that has to be the way, but thinking, how can that help us engage in shared conversations about what we think would be good?
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting reflection to make. And I wanted to ask you, because I'm quite interested, I know that when we're talking about feminism and feminist ideology, sometimes we see just a belief clash with other beliefs, whether it be cultural, social, religious. But what's also really interesting is looking at, as you've mentioned before, within feminism, there's lots of different ideas as well that people commit to and live by. And when you have that challenge of kind of wading through those different ideas, and then you have different communication styles, like, for example, communicating through social media, which is often very inflammatory, do you feel that that type of communication potentially undermines those discussions or potentially alienates people who actually probably have the same beliefs, but just the way it's being presented to them? And you also mentioned before, which I think was super interesting, that intersection between feminist beliefs and things like capitalism and like the profitability of posting on social media. Do you think that potentially also muddies the water?
For sure. I think that's a really useful set of questions, because I think, yeah, definitely the kind of social media cultures that my participants, who were, you know, all self-identified feminists, young feminists between the ages of 18 to 28 when they first started participating, that was a real challenge, because social media, it's not like a neutral blank space in which we communicate. I mean, there's no blank space in which we communicate. It's always shaped by context and what we expect to ask and how we are expected to respond. But for sure, I think social media brings a number of challenges. So one is that the premise that you have to respond, the one thing. You have to respond, which, and sometimes you're not best placed to respond. You actually might not have a sense of the full context of a particular thing that you're responding to. You might not have a lot of knowledge about it. You might feel very strongly about it, which is great. And you don't always have to, you know, be an expert to respond, but the expectation that you have to make have a response and that be visible, that places a lot of pressure on the person. Also because then there's this, I guess, equally difficult challenge where you are really judged for your response.
Yeah.
You know, and it's you're judged according to a standard of, are you being authentic to who you are? And the thing is, we're all contradictory people. We don't we to say that we change our values from day to day, but the world is very complex. And you just because, like, you generally are a progressive person doesn't mean that, you know, you have to. I mean, you cannot actually respond to every single wrong that happens in the world. And it makes social media makes it seem simple because all this stuff is streaming into our feed, but you cannot actually do that. So you're being held to a higher standard, an impossible standard, and you're expected to be out there. That really muddies the waters. And I think that that expectation that you should judge and also not be complicit, that framing as well, that kind of opposition between either you're complicit or you're a good activist, I think is really unhelpful. And that's something that is also really a big part of social media as well. Because it means you then have to then a push to maybe call out something where you don't know the full context, and it maybe encourages people to be more harsh than they actually mean. And, you know, we don't, it helps when you have, you know, bodies in a room where you can kind of see facial expression, all of those things that help you focus not just on the text as well, which can make something feel a lot harsher than even the way it was intended.
Yeah, when I think about my social media feeds and any time I see any, like, anti-feminist sentiment, or it's like, why feminism doesn't work or whatever, it's often accompanied by a screenshot of a singular, like, conversation that is, like, two messages. And it's really interesting that you said that, because I do believe that we all communicate things differently, and when you do decide to stick up or advocate, it tends to be the situation where you almost are representing the entire belief system in doing that, which means that if it's not articulated correctly, or even like in social media, it could be something as simple as you write something and there's a simple typo that could potentially be used as an argument to undermine what you've just said. So I think that's really interesting. That idea of when, going back to what you said before about when we're talking about feminism and why we should be all kind of embracing it and kind of adopting it into our life, it needs to be on a systems level, thinking about the greater picture as opposed to these little individual discussions that we're having.
Yeah, and taking a bit of the pressure off the individual discussions, because I think part of it, I guess social media culture is making you feel ultimately responsible for everything, and you're just one person, you know, and if you think you're ultimately responsible for everything, it does mean that people take on so much emotional weight in every single thing they do, whereas we do need to be working together with others and trying to be changing policies and doing all these other things together. It's not just on you to have include everything and make, you know, your post absolutely perfect.
You could never make your post perfect because
no, you can't.
The world's so polarizing one way to the other. So, you know, 50% will say good on you and 50% will then harass you for it. And then having to cope with all of that, like, it's not just the stress of the message, it's then the stress of the response to it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's pretty, no wonder so many people aren't on social media, honestly. It's too hard.
But I think that was one of the things that I really appreciated you highlighting in your podcast is that the unfair mental load and expectations that are put on these young self-identifying feminists on social media. And I found it almost heartbreaking listening to their stories of saying, I didn't feel like I was equipped to say something. I felt like I didn't have all the information. It's exhausting to try and have an opinion about everything, but I'm going to get criticized for my silence. And I'm going to also get criticized when I do post something, and then the burnout that comes from that. And I was just like, people are going to give up. People are going to absolutely leave this space and give up if they feel like their voices aren't going to be held in a meaningful way. But
or if their mental health just can't cope with it.
I know. I'm really... So I guess from my perspective, I'm like, what... Do you worry... Well, firstly, Fiona, you said people are leaving social media. Do you feel like that's true, that people are leaving social media?
I think they're taking more intentional detoxes for certain periods of time. But the trouble is, increasingly, our whole identities need to be sort of visible and verified to count as a person.
Yeah.
You know, generally. And so people can't totally leave because they're going to leave their networks. They're going to leave that sense of easy accessibility to what's going on. This sense that you have to, like, if, you know, you're about to go for a job interview, people are going to check, so who are you? And have that kind of visible trail. So I think, yeah, I think definitely people are trying to withdraw from social media in different ways. So they might have very small private accounts on Instagram or something, or they might not post, or like me, they might just try to really curate their feed to just focus on dogs. Or but even then, you can't, like, anyway, it's not a safe space necessarily. But yeah, I think it's really just, it's so ingrained into our everyday in terms of how we're able to do things that I think.
But that's only in the last 10-15 years. Like, it wasn't ingrained into me growing up.
No, but it's really become such a part of the
I think
the
it's
landscape.
A huge thing for millennials and Gen Zs and the alphas rather than the Gen Xs. I mean, we invented it, but I feel like it's easier for my generation to tip out of that.
Yeah.
Because we didn't grow up with that than say your generations, you know. I couldn't care less if I wasn't on social media. But the thing that annoys me is I have to check it because that's how a lot of my millennial friends contact me now, is through the Instagram. They send me a direct message and I think, I haven't seen that for a week. Oh, my God.
Yeah, like, that's me too. But, yeah, I think for sure there is a difference with who already has established networks.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have established networks of friends, of colleagues, you know, that are off line, so to speak, then you don't need it as much. But for lots of younger people, you do need it because you don't have that firm sense of network of that kind of social capital you can draw on. Yeah.
Are we making movement in the feminist movement? Because I think about the 70s, burn your bra, you know, like you talked about the different phases. No, seriously, you know. Now we've had the Me Too in this generation. But are we actually making movement? Is it getting any better? I just wonder, is it getting any better for the cause of feminism? Is it actually improving? Or is it going in cycles where it improves for a while and then it goes back again, then it improves for a while because people pop up again and go, well, let's not... You know, I feel like it's forever in a cycle that it comes and goes, but is that a fair thing to say?
And can I just add to that question as well? When you were talking about feminism before, you mentioned how it's, and this is actually something that's really resonated with me, the idea of looking at it, we talk about waves and how it's all culturally relative. We may see at one point what the focus of feminism was at that point is actually not enough in quotation marks to what it is now, but actually at the time it was the most important thing. What do you think, just as an add-on to Fee's question, what do you think at the moment in this current generation is like the main concern of feminism and are we working towards it?
So are we making movement? I mean, there's always movement and there's always wins. I mean, you can always count as a win when there is even any money that's allocated to, you know, organizations that work in gendered violence. We can see, you know, even though it was really horrible how this came about, the process, the plebiscite a number of years ago, at least the result was favorable rather than totally soul destroying.
Yeah.
You know, related gains in general, but there's also so much blowback. I think we can say that, I mean, I'll speak to an everyday level sometimes. So, you know, I've recently had a baby. When speaking to some of my older colleagues, they talk about how when they had babies a couple of decades ago, they didn't feel they could, these are women.
Yeah.
They didn't feel they could even talk about that. They would not talk about the fact that they were extremely sick, you know, when they were toddlers.
Mm.
They wouldn't talk about the sleepless nights. They wouldn't have any form of complaint.
Yeah.
They would just try to pretend they were the same as before and carry on. Whereas now they feel that there's so much more space to be open about those things. The fact that, you know, when my baby started childcare, she was really sick basically every second week and she couldn't go to childcare and you just had to throw the plans out for the week and stay home because there's nothing else you can do and you can't ask anyone else to look after her. You get sick, you're on, you know, waking up every couple of hours a night. Yeah, so that is, I think, you can see there are shifts in being able to address those experiences.
Paid parental leave.
Yeah, yeah. Those things. So I think that we need to celebrate the gains, but also see where we still need to move forward. And I think there are particular challenges to now. There is so much pushback, blowback. We can see that we do have this sense, there's, you know, an increasingly incensed conservative and reactionary element that's very vocal in media culture, might not represent even a majority of people, but that think that there's all these minoritized people that are going too far.
Yeah.
We see that's increasingly a very strong and present discourse. And so, for example, in terms of recent discussions about Indigenous rights in Australia, for example, we can see that there's a lot of pushback against this sense that there are these gains. So it's a really polarized environment. We can see politically across the world that there is that constant, there's real an extreme right that is becoming a lot more vocal and actually becoming just so commonplace for young people to know about. I think there are real challenges, but that's also because there have been these gains, I guess, to answer in like a long-winded way. I think this current wave of feminism, in some ways, and I'm talking sort of everyday feminisms, obviously they're real different groups, different positions, but I think one of the focuses of this current wave is to be the best feminist possible one of the main drives. And that means a kind of inwards critique, is in that you're constantly assessing yourself in how could I be better? Could I be, am I good? Am I bad? You know, just constantly evaluating yourself to critique. And in some ways, I'm not saying that's not useful in, you know, good to be conscious of where we could be more open and shift the ways we interact with others, but it can actually reinforce a lot of existing social pressures and the uneven burden of blame, particularly on women, to constantly be saying, I'm not good enough, essentially, and I need to be better, as opposed to looking more generally in society and saying, maybe there are other people that need to kind of step up and we need to, you know, be shifting again structurally what is possible.
That's such an interesting reflection of moving from the individual to the system and what do we need to be looking at and what do we need to be addressing in terms of that, because I totally agree with you, that kind of self-individual flagellation almost that happens as, am I a good enough feminist and am I doing enough to progress the cause, yet not necessarily acknowledging the systems that may need to be changing. And we may not have the influence or the power over those systems yet to be doing that. You're going to say something.
I am, because I saw the play Julia last night, which is about Julia Gillard. And for our listeners who don't live in Australia, she's Australia's one and only female prime minister, who is a feminist, like, let's face it, she is. who faced extreme sexism during her time from men and women. It was terrible. Of course, they brought up all the comments that she experienced. It's shocking. Anyway, at the end of the play, standing ovation, because it was very, very good, I started to cry. I had a tear coming out of my eye. And the reason being is it wasn't because the performance moved me that much. Did I do enough during that time? I'm ashamed. Mm. You know, like, I voted for her, okay? Mm. Was that enough? Like, wow. Like, that's during my lifetime, not that long ago. I didn't do enough. Mm. Like, I really felt that. And standing in a middle-class white audience mostly, thinking, we're all to blame for this happening. Mm-hmm. We're all giving the standing ovation, but really, shame on us. Mm. Like, just what you were saying about you can feel that you don't do enough, I think. Anyway, it's just a thought.
Yeah, I think it's useful to think about our feelings as... Our feelings are also an indication of our relationships with other people and what is possible, you know. But I think it's also useful to acknowledge that emotions are also structuring, in that there are certain groups of people who are more likely to feel shame and certain others that don't feel that responsibility.
Yeah.
Some people are expected to feel grateful that other people do things, and others are more likely to think, well, entitled to particular things. So I think it's useful to reflect on our positions when we feel those things. And I think those feelings are... I think it's useful to sit with those feelings and not think, I shouldn't have had those feelings, or, you know, but think your feelings are registering that it was egregious what happened to Julia Gillard. But how can we, you know, take that...
How can
forward?
We not make it happen again?
How can we take that forward and not just put all these pressures on individual women or representatives of other kind of underrepresented people in positions of power and say, it's all on them. If we just put these people in leadership, things will be fine, and not think about the blowback and the ramifications for them. It's not really... I mean, who would want to be the next person of colour that's a prime minister in Australia? It's not possible if you really think about it. It would not be possible for them to do that in a way that would be healthy.
100%.
In the current context. So or, you know, the next woman.
After the show, I said to my friend who I was with, I need to talk. Like, let's go have a coffee. I need to have a chat about what we just saw. And we were listening to people. We were walking back into the city and we were listening to people. And people were saying, Australia is not ready for another female prime minister. Mm. That's what they were saying. Mm. And so, knowing I was coming into this interview today, I was thinking, where is feminism then? Where are we? Because, and I heard someone actually say, no, a person of colour will be before a woman next.
Australia's, like a male person of colour.
Yeah, correct. Yep. Australia is ready for a male person of colour, but not a woman.
They?
I don't know. No, but these are the conversations I'm hearing around me as I'm walking into the city and feeling more and more rage as I'm walking fast.
But,
going,
you know,
oh my God.
Like, the interesting thing, coming back to one of the points you made before, is that thought of the person in leadership has to be perfect, and that they cannot be contradictory, and they have to align with all of our values and beliefs and attitudes. And I am friends with someone who is in parliament, who is a woman of colour, who, when I elevate her voice because she is saying incredible things, I get criticised because she hasn't said things about other things. And I just sit there and go, what the heck is happening?
Yeah.
She is in leadership and doing the best that she can, and we cannot take a step back and celebrate that, but also acknowledge the complexity and the nuance that she has to deal with every day in a system that needs a lot of work. But we're going to criticise what they're not saying. And I find it frustrating. So I don't think we're ready for a woman. I don't think we're ready for a person of colour. And it makes me sad.
I agree. I think the thing is, it is a maddening situation. Like, obviously, it's so... When you have an ideal that these things shouldn't be only accessible to particular groups of people, of course it's enraging. But I think it's that we don't need to... one thing about media is that it often focuses on the spokesperson or the representative or the leader. Yeah. But that's not the only focus of attention that we could have. We could be thinking more about how do we change things from the bottom up? How do we have some more of these conversations with young people in schools? How mm-hmm. do we... Those kinds of things, I think, are just, really useful in just trying to think about alternatives beyond pinning all our hopes on particular forms of representation.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very good point. I'm wondering, in our closing moments, whether you want to share what your hopes were for putting your podcast out there and what you are wanting to generate in terms of conversation or action.
So the podcast aims to talk about some of the themes in the project, I guess, in ways that feel accessible and connect with the everyday experiences that people are having who do want to make a change and are either chronically online, as one of my participants put it, or just kind of, engaging in social media, just in a more kind of in and out kind of way. So in terms of the podcast, I guess what I was hoping was that it would provide a kind of space of reflection.
Mm.
Some of my participants, actually a lot of them, even though everyone was a bit disaffected by the social media they were on generally, and that ranged from Instagram to TikTok, Twitter, now X, not really Facebook, but they were quite disaffected by what they saw. But a lot of them felt that podcasts were actually really useful spaces of reflection. And I think it's because they feel embodied in a way. They're not just bits of text to quickly look at, scroll through, and then have to react or respond or move on. They're a space where you can hear things that are, even though they're prepared, they're improvised. You hear, people interacting with each other, and it provided kind of the sense of having people hash out different positions. So I was hoping to, in a way, provide a bit of that sense of an experience where you can listen to differing perspectives without feeling you have to react in a particular way and have a little space of time that's uninterrupted from, everything else. So that was, I guess, one of the more modest aims that I was hoping to achieve through the podcast. But also provide a medium through which my participants could listen to some of the themes from the project in terms of acknowledging the real difficulties of being feminist now and try to take a step back from those pressures and expectations that you have to fill ever-increasing number of check boxes to even be heard, to constantly put your needs, political needs, on hold because you haven't been perfect in the first place. So trying to, I guess, give some space to that and raise some questions about how we can contest some of those pressures and really acknowledge that they're really big forces in our lives if we are on social media, but also as social media has permeated the everyday, how we are treating people, more generally.
And you did it through the best medium possible, a podcast, exactly what your studies have been showing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was really fun. And I, it's really cool that it's out there. And actually, as a researcher, it's one of the first things where I could really share with, family and friends and actually feel like, this is something that we can talk about.
You did a brilliant job with it.
Thank you.
It is fascinating. I've listened to it multiple times, so I really encourage our listeners. We'll put a link to your podcast in our show notes so that people can find you. But Feminist Not Fearless, available on all streaming platforms, and definitely worth a listen. Very well considered, beautiful nuance, and some fascinating conversations on there. So thank you so much. Hi everyone, it's Dash. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast, and don't forget to leave a rating and a review. If you've enjoyed our show and like what you're hearing, tell all your friends and family and hit that subscribe button. If you want to hear our updates and know when episodes drop, follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. And our original music was composed and performed by the amazing Luke Champion.